It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
So, do you remember which episodes we did big crazy things for, like big celebration things to commemorate?
Just one in 100 and 500, as far as I recall.
Exactly. So, based on that, I would think the next one would be 1,000.
I mean, yeah, I guess.
Which is my way of saying it's perfectly reasonable that we didn't do jack shit for whatever episode number this might be. And I'm not going to say it because I don't want to steal your thunder of the one thing you do on this podcast.
My thunder, okay.
I assume you looked up beforehand what episode number this is.
Yeah, I hope I can remember.
I'll try not to talk too long. But yeah. No, I legitimately have had some anxiety about this. I'm like, we should do something. And then the other day I was like, we didn't do anything for 200 or 300 or 400.
No.
Why? That's not fun. And also, this whole thing is predicated on doing very, very little work. So, count yourselves lucky we're here, people. Hello, everyone! Welcome to Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that is exactly what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking right now, and you're like, how many podcasts are like that? We're the only one.
Only one.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 600.
Sorry, gotta do it like a Kermit flail. I can't. I don't have a good Kermit. Most people have a good Kermit. I don't have a good Kermit.
I don't think I have a good Kermit either.
What are the classics that supposedly everybody have? Christopher Walken?
No.
William Shatner?
No.
Kermit?
No.
What other ones? If you know other impressions that like everybody has a version of, tell us in the blog, magicaltalkinghat.com. But those are the big three I can think of. Except everybody's Captain Kirk. It's not William Shatner. It's Captain Kirk. And it's not Captain Kirk. It's Kevin Pollock. It's Kevin Pollock's impression of William Shatner as Captain Kirk. That is the impression everybody else does.
Okay.
No, it's true. It's like a thing. His impression became so the standard that that's what everybody does. Because Shatner, it's an extreme version that Shatner never, or at least very rarely, managed in his.
You mean the whole halting stuff? Going yes. Like that.
Yes, and the weird arbitrary turns of body, kind of like he's dancing the robot. Yeah.
I didn't know who did that first. I didn't know who did it first, but I know what you're talking about.
I don't know
about
that he did it first. He's held up as the gold standard. And if you ever watch Kevin Pollak do a Captain Kirk, you're like, that's what everybody's trying to imitate. Like it's just very clearly like that's what everybody's trying to do. Fun fact, so after Star Trek, William Shatner got the show T.J. Hooker, where he was just like a cop. Mm-hmm. And there was a backdoor pilot in T.J. Hooker starring Sharon Stone.
Hmm.
as I can't remember if she, I think I can't remember if she was a cop or an investigative journalist. It didn't matter. She was solving the mystery of the week, and it didn't do well enough. But they had an episode where the two of them hung out and didn't get along, and then kind of got along. You know that deal. For those of you just joining us, it's fascinating that you picked 600 as the starting point. Because a nice round number, you thought you were starting over. Maybe we do it in seasons. We don't do it in seasons. excuse me. Oh, we're here, and you're welcome. We have a hat. It is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks, all of the folks everywhere should and do sometimes write in to that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with whatever the crap they want. And we get forced by the hat magically to read them and talk about them here in our forum, the People's Court. How come the People's Court was a thing for like decades? And then suddenly they decided that was going to be the new fad. It wasn't like People's Court was a hit and then they were like, oh, let's do all these other judge shows.
It doesn't seem
People's
like
Court
that
was
happened.
Around forever and ever and ever and ever. Then I wonder, I guess maybe Judge Judy springboarded it. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how it seems to me too, that People's Court was all by itself for a long time and then all these others happened. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe that's just how I perceive it. But I think the way it seemed to happen in my perception, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed like it was People's Court for a long time. And then when Judge Wapner was going to leave, or when, you know, he was going to be done with it, that's when people started thinking, hey, we don't just have to replace Judge Wapner. We could make other ones.
That's
of
true,
these.
But they did replace Wapner.
Yeah.
With Ed Koch. That's the only reason I know who Ed Koch is.
But I think for some reason, people just didn't, you know, like you said, usually when something's a hit, everybody wants to replicate it. But I don't think it occurred to anybody. Maybe people just thought that it was about Wapner. Like his personality was kind of the thing and you weren't going to replicate that. And then they realized when you could replace him or they needed to replace him, then people started thinking, well, why couldn't we just, we could cast someone.
I think you could be onto something, and I have evidence.
Hmm.
To my knowledge, Judge Wapner, who was a former judge when he did People's Court.
Yeah.
Is the only one on any of those shows, including Ed Koch, who was ever actually a judge. So maybe in the process of replacing them, they were like, oh, fuck, we don't need a judge. They're all just signing TV contracts. Got to be a real judge.
That could be too.
And then
they just
like,
realized they didn't.
Because, I mean, it's not like Wapner was known for his, you know, charisma and personality on the show. So then they were like, hey, we can get somebody who's like all fucked. And a lot of them have, you know, there's some that are lawyers and have, but others are just whatever the hell.
Yeah,
and in fact, in Arrested Development, they're putting together a show where Judge Reinhold is the judge. So, like, I haven't looked it up if Judge Reinhold's name is really Judge. It feels like it has to be, because why would that be your stage name? But that means there's a kid on the playground named Judge when he's little. That's weird.
Yeah.
How's your week? We are doing this early because William has life and goes on exciting adventures and things tomorrow. So, and it's weird because also I have lunch with a friend periodically, and we usually have it on Wednesday just by coincidence. It wasn't set up that way. And by coincidence, this week we had it on Tuesday. So I have spent the whole week off a day. I was so glad I talked to my sister this morning, because that's something I usually do on Wednesday. So I'm anchoring myself with that, because you and other people are trying to throw me off, make me think the week's ending quicker. So how's your week been?
Well, school this quarter is ending.
Almost done.
Yeah. When people see this, it'll be tomorrow. I got all the work done early. I could have just taken this week off, but to get the work done early, I had to skip readings that weren't relevant to the work that needed done. But I wanted to do those readings. I wanted to do those readings because, I mean, it was important stuff. You know, I needed to know it. I didn't need to know it to do the assignments, but I, you know, I want to know it. So, and it's a lot of reading that I skipped because the projects were too involved. I couldn't possibly read everything. So this week I don't have anything to do assignment wise. So I'm catching up on all the reading, and I'll probably be working on that until the end of the day on Friday. But that's really all I've been doing is just trying to finish up school, because there's two big projects in the last week. And but I think I finished strong. I think, you know, I think it was a good quarter after all, but it was really rough. I mean, fellow students were talking to me about it, and they were also having some real problems. I had one fellow student who dropped one of the classes because it was so rough. And so, yeah, it was a really, really hard. I talked to, so this was the first time, this quarter was the first time I had TAs, didn't have TAs before. TAs in two classes, TAs in both of them. And I got to talk to one of them quite a bit, you know, and she acknowledged that, yeah, you know, this is the way this course was put together is, you know, pretty hard with the reading being really dense and there's a lot of it. And of course it was, did I say this already that the material itself was about, like, it's covering suicide, sexual assault?
You said it to me, I don't think, on the, well, okay, that part, yes, you have mentioned.
Yeah. So
I thought you meant how it related to you much more specifically.
No. I did have strong personal responses to some of the stuff that was being covered. And that was rough. I mean, none of the other quarters have dealt with, you know, things like trauma and, you know, sexual trauma with kids, you know, all that stuff that's really difficult to think about. And the textbook, you know, did what it should do, which is, you know, it dealt with it, you know, not just clinically, but trying, you know, trying to get you as a future person who's going to work in this field to understand what this is really like to work with clients who are going through these things. And it's rough. And, you know, and the TA for
there should be a track where you could just be a therapist, but for, like, non-traumatic stuff. Like, I'm just there to help people get over their anxiety of fear of failure, like that kind of stuff. Not any of the rest. I just want the nice stuff.
My TA, one of the reasons she was teaching the teacher's assistants for this course, crisis, it was a crisis intervention course is what it is because where she works, you know, in her day job, she does a lot of crisis stuff. And she said, yeah, it is rough. It's every bit as much as the book portrays it. It is hard. And her agency has to respond to a critical incident or, you know, some kind of crisis somewhere, you know, she's taking, like, a lot of time off right after that, because it's really, really hard. Really hard.
I'm very impressed with this stuff. I had a friend who spent a couple of years doing the regional crisis hotline. And nowadays, that's very convenient because you get your training and then it just rings at your house. So you don't ever have to go anywhere or anything. And that's handy. But, like, she obviously didn't talk a lot of detail, but just the basic kind of stuff. I was just like, no, I couldn't even begin. And especially in that thing, because it's just an anonymous phone call. And so, like, you never know what happened. And, but all that stuff, I am super impressed with everybody who does that, except I won't be impressed with William. I could never, and I would never. And,
well, I've dealt with some crisis situations before, and so I know what kind of headspace a person can get into to do it. Like, you know, it's an emergency. This needs to be done. You don't have time to be upset. You don't have time to let your little issues get in the way. And so a lot of times, you know, people of a certain temperament, and I seem to be one of those people, at least so far in my life, that can set that stuff aside and really focus and get it done. But like everybody else,
I'm determined to let all my little issues get in the way constantly.
But like everybody else, once the crisis is passed and I don't need to set it aside anymore, I'm a wreck. I mean, you know, and that's just what happens. You set it all aside. You get the thing done, but once it's done and you don't need to put up that partition or whatever it is anymore, the partition comes down and you are a puddle on the floor. I mean, it's just, that's how it is.
Growing up, I had two life-threatening situations, which in both cases my mom dealt with, and my mom luckily was a trained registered nurse. Yep. And she was great, and then as soon as it was over, she fell. In fact, one time we were on vacation and we ended up going to an ER in a strange town, and after it was done, they just had us leave, like it was a, oh no, this was a reaction to this, take this medicine. And literally as we're walking out the door, she just starts stumbling and like tears start streaming down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the absolute best and most effective crisis workers, as I understand it, based on what I've seen in this course, have that experience, you know. And of course, some people, and again, this probably happens with the best crisis workers too. Sometimes you try to do that thing, that partition thing, and it just doesn't happen. I mean, you just can't, you're going to turn to a puddle now because it's just too much, or you've been doing it for too long, you know, and you're burned out or whatever. And so that's another thing is if you're going to do this kind of work, you know, you have to know what your limits are, and you have to know, okay, I need to take this much time off. This is what I need to do during the time off. Then when I come back, I know that I'll be able to do it. So it's really,
you're probably going to have a harder time because you're not going to supplement with drugs and alcohol, which I think helps a lot of people with it after that. If TV shows have taught me anything.
Well, it's, I, you know, I have been really interested, like in, and the other class was addiction. So it was like a double, you know, you went from one and then you went to the other, and it was just nightmare after nightmare after nightmare scenario you're reading about. But I am interested in these things and in being able to do crisis intervention. And again, I have some experience that tells me I could maybe do it, but you know, again, I would have to learn how, which I currently don't know how to do. I would have to learn how to know when that limit gets hit, stop, properly replenish myself so that I can get back into it. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I might know how to know when to stop, but like I've got 3 weeks. I'm going to have 3 weeks to recover from these courses. I have no idea how to do that. I don't know how. I don't know what I'm going to do between, I mean, I know things that I can do, and we were asked in our courses, like, well, what's your plan? What are you going to do for self-care?
But you have no experience to know how effective it is.
Right. I can come up with stuff, and then I do those things, and I don't, are they working even? I don't even know how to tell. Well, but
you're learning happens while you're in school and they don't let you near people yet.
That's true. But, and by the time the quarter happens, I don't really feel like whatever I should have done in those 3 weeks, I didn't do whatever that was. And I did, you know, I did other things that I've been told are supposed to work, or maybe I did them wrong. I mean, you know what I mean? It's a whole bunch of ignorance and trial and error and failure. And, you know, I do worry a little bit.
Learning about yourself. You got to know yourself real well.
I sure would like to figure it out, because it's stressful to not know how, you know, these 10-week courses are really semesters smashed into 10 weeks. They're very stressful. A lot of my fellow learners are getting burned out. And so it would be nice if during this 3 weeks, if I can like make the most of it and really feel better when the quarter starts. So, I mean, I'm going to try things like I always do, and hopefully it'll work out. But
this
is a real struggle for me.
You should play a lot of Call of Duty. I feel like that's going to work for you real well.
I mean, I think I need to, I don't know. I mean,
eat a lot of chocolate.
I think I need to practice more things like just meditation or whatever. I mean, I've done meditation before, and I've been
a huge one. And I mean, I have experienced this with other people and myself sometimes. don't do shit related to school. Don't think about shit related to school. Don't talk about shit related to school. You are not a student for 3 weeks.
That's hard.
It is, and the thinking is harder than the talking, but you can do the talking. And if, say, you hang out with a particular person most of the time, you can tell them, if I start talking about shit from school, shut me the hell up.
Because
throw a beanbag in my face.
For most of my life, because this is something else my TA, I had great conversations with this person. I really liked her a lot. You know, she asked me, well, what are your hobbies? And, you know, I do have
like podcasting.
I do have things that I do, but I realized, you know, I write and I do other things, but I realized that one of my biggest hobbies up until I started school was this kind of stuff. Like, you know, reading books like this and thinking about things like this was my hobby. So when the 3 weeks comes, I'm like looking at the DSM. Remember, that's what I did.
You're going to manage tech support operators. There we go.
No. Yeah, this was my hobby for 30 years.
And now you've ruined it by making it a profession.
No, it's awesome. But I do have to realize, okay, William, maybe during school you're getting enough of it and you can do something else.
And this is the thing, because you and I joke about, we essentially do amateur therapy on each other for fun. And one thing I've been dealing with is maybe I should do less of that, because it just puts a lot of thoughts cycling in my head that only sort of make me more agitated. As much as I sort of find it interesting and enjoy the process, I'm not sure the degree to which I do it is good on my mental health.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Trying to do a lot more just base emotion things. When I do X, how do I feel? Not did I enjoy it? Did I find it worthwhile? How do I actually feel when/after I do X? Because there's a lot of things, and I think this is true for a lot of people, things that people think they enjoy and they do them, and it's like, yeah, when you do those, you get real tense. Like, I'm not sure you're enjoying them inside, like that kind of, and I think I have a lot of those things.
I mean, because I'm already thinking of things I want to do, you know, related to human behavioral science stuff I want to do at some point during the 3 weeks. Like, something I started doing the last 3 weeks that I didn't get to finish, I want to do this 3 weeks. But maybe you're right. Maybe I just need to. But I really
Whole talk about this over pancakes. Well,
maybe I really want to do it though.
Don't do it. I don't think it's going to be good for you.
I want to do it.
There will be time.
When will I do it? Yeah, I mean, there will be. Of course there will be. You're right. Yeah, I don't have to do it right
now. It is unlikely once you graduate and go into practice that you will have a 10-week period where your patients bring you as much shit as these textbooks brought you.
Well, okay, here's one of the reasons.
Right now is a very bad time, even though it's all just in your textbooks, because it is all of it at once.
Here's why I want to do it, though. Because it helps me contextualize the stuff I'm learning about. And see, next quarter, we're going to actually look at like pathologies and stuff. It's going to be really interesting. We're going to be, you know,
when does talking your therapist about... get back?
What?
Ask her what she thinks. Yeah, see? You already fucking know. There. That's how you know. And this is a thing I do too. If you can imagine telling your therapist and you already know what they're going to say, then you knew.
Okay. Gosh, Brian, do it.
There will be time. Also, I understand the desire to contextualize things, but your textbooks will not burst into flames after a particular course is done. And you don't seem to have a hard time keeping up with the coursework mentally.
Well, I mean, this quarter was hard, but I mean,
yeah,
I got through it.
But you're still going to get a pretty good grade out of it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think so.
Here's the thing. My concession to this stuff is that I am not yelling at you for finishing the work and then being like, but I'm going to read all this stuff for the next 3 days, because it's still technically in that week.
Yeah.
So get all that shit out of the way.
I will. And then be done. You're right. No, you're right.
And I'm going to talk to your wife. And if she catches you, we're going to put a shock collar on you. It's going to be a whole thing. Be like, no, good William.
You're right. You're right. I can do it for 3 weeks. I can do it.
Do it. It will be better for you. Worst case scenario, you'll be chomping at the bit for this stuff in 3 weeks, which will be good because you'll be starting school again.
That's right. You're right.
But you need 3 weeks of whatever makes William feel good. And if you don't know what that is, this is your time to figure that out.
Yeah, I do need to figure it out.
That's an important thing that a lot of people don't know. The stuff you're interested in and the stuff you do regularly is not necessarily the stuff that makes you feel good or releases tension or anything like that. It's you got to find out. I've been working out. I was talking with my friend about it. We're both, which is weird for me because I'm me. Exercise and music are huge ones for me. And it's not like I necessarily enjoy exercise, but I feel really good after I've done exercise, and it makes a ton of difference. And music also, if I listen to music, it can just, regardless of the music and regardless of the particulars of the negative mood, it can just always make me feel better. Also, in my case, recreational drugs, highly recommend. But otherwise, I don't know. No, I should be clear on this. Drugs are very serious. You should not make any lasting financial decisions or operate any heavy machinery while on drugs. And people listening out there, it is important that you know that I think you should not do drugs unless you want to. I don't care. And to be fair, I stole most of that from Daniel O'Brien, but I just wanted my position clear. None of my business.
Anyway, how was your week?
Sleep study was awful.
I forgot like to ask about that.
A legit like trauma that I'm going to be reliving.
Oh no. Why? What happened?
I mean, they're always bad.
Hmm.
Imagine you're having issues with sleep, and the answer is, okay, you're going to go to a strange place you've never been before. We're going to glue electrodes all over your head and over various parts of your body. And then we're going to wrap some very tight bands around parts of your torso. And then we're going to put you in a very uncomfortable sort of hospital bed thing. And we're going to let you know right up front, somebody is going to be watching and listening to you all night, and you're connected to machines. So if you need to get up to pee or something, you just have to call out into the empty room and people will come in. Yep. Now, sleep. By the way, it's like 9 p.m. and you're going to be done and heading home at 4:30 a.m. Now,
right.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like already right. Shit. And I was expecting that. I had a tech I did not enjoy.
Oh.
And what's weird is I'm pretty sure it's the same tech I had in 06 and 07. I thought I remembered him and he thought he remembered me. But he's one of those who it is inconceivable to him that he would not tell you his views on whatever pops into his head or that any of it would be wrong. So, first of all, he did a lot of diagnosing and prescribing that I think legally he's not supposed to do. But he also told me a lot about some of the intricacies of his relationship with his wife. And also about his, frankly, un- unconventional views on climate change. Also his feelings about Jason Momoa and Johnny Depp. None of this was prompted. None of this was prompted. And yeah, it was just awful. And to add to all of that, I slept for about 30 minutes the whole night. Apparently, I was falling asleep and then I would kick my legs. So we got confirmation. I kicked the shit out of my legs, which was the reason Trish was making me go back. So I'm just really hoping they'll give me drugs for that rather than try new things and go back for another sleep study.
Where was this at? Mercy?
No. Mercy? I've never been to Mercy in my life. I don't believe in Catholics, which is not to say that I don't belong to the doctrine. I do not believe Catholics exist. I've never seen one. You cannot prove to me they are.
My two sleep studies were there. And they were exactly like you described. Exactly that.
And I mean, I don't even know how you'd make it better. Like I don't think like they're fucking around. And if they other than you could get a nicer bed. But I'd say it is nicer than an average hospital bed, but it's still kind of a hospital. I don't know that you could make it better. It's just a sucky thing.
Yeah. I mean, it must work. I mean, like, the two sleep studies I did, I just didn't sleep enough for them to get any data. And I couldn't believe anybody would sleep long enough under those circumstances.
I did in the other ones. This time. Although it's funny, at 3:30, he was ready to let me go. Because he's like, you're not sleeping. We're not getting anything. But I was like, my wife drove me here. If I go now, I'll basically be sitting outside this building till 5 a.m. And he's like, all right, you can go back to sleep. And that was when I actually fell asleep for about a half hour. So, But they got a lot of data, just not the data about what happens when I'm sleeping. So hopefully we won't need it. We'll see. But it's done. What else? It's been a busy week. Like I said, I had lunch with a friend. That was fun. The friend also is in therapy now, and I had a lot to say about that. And that was really fun because, you know, I love sharing therapy experiences with people. And also this particular friend, I have talked to them a lot about my therapy. So it's fun now to hear about theirs, and, you know, compare, contrast, stuff like that. We watched Thor: Love and Thunder. Because it's now on Disney Plus.
Yeah, it is.
So we can all watch it for no additional fee.
Yeah. I think it's on our list of things, but we haven't seen it yet.
I had heard it was not great. So I was prepared.
Yeah.
And you know my feelings on Thor. The first two Thor movies are in my bottom of all MCU movies, and Ragnarok's near the top. And this is also Taika Waititi directing this one. It's bad.
Really?
Like, I was surprised at how bad. And not for weird, specific, you know, political reasons on my part. There's lots of things. No, this is like legitimately, it's just, okay. Ragnarok was a huge hit, and Ragnarok was bug fuck crazy and hugely comedic.
Yeah.
So this movie, they were like, let's just do everything we did in Ragnarok times 1,000 in terms of how ridiculous, how many jokes per minute, how much nonsense, all this stuff. But on top of that, clearly no one involved in this movie wanted to be there. Or be like, it is the most phoned in thing.
Wow.
And it doesn't, I am pleased to say, if you're like into the MCU and shit, like you don't, this one doesn't really tie in. This isn't going to have impact on it. It's really, and I mean, it kind of makes sense. Hemsworth's been doing this for fucking ever. Natalie Portman already fucking wanted out. That's why she hasn't been in a lot of the recent ones. A little weirded why she came back for this. And yeah, Taika Waititi is doing 8,000 things right now. Like he's got so many projects he's working on. Yeah, it was just constant jokes, most of which were not funny, nothing which was consistent at all in terms of jokes. We did the usual thing. Christian Bale was playing the hell out of a villain that was completely wasted and was really fascinating to me. And I had a lot of questions about his villain, and there's a lot of stuff it's one of those villains that you heard a lot about things he did and you didn't see him do the things. That's not so great. And yeah, just constantly trying to be funny and not really nailing that, and pounding jokes into the ground, the same bit over and over and over and over again, and nobody really gave a shit. Also, there is a subplot that is incredibly serious and kind of depressing. And guess what? They handled it real bad. And it goes through the whole thing.
Wow.
And yeah, they handled it real bad. Here's what I'm going to say to help people's brains. And this was enough of a deal that bugged us. That I finally looked it up afterwards, but also Disney put out a little short on Disney Plus explaining it, because this bothered people. So, as you would know, if you saw any trailer or knew anything about this, in this movie, Jane Foster has Mjolnir.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all like, how the fuck did... And we see how she gets it. But it comes from a place that we're like, it wasn't there. Captain fucking America had it. What is going on? The answer is Captain America had an alternate timeline one. In Endgame, they went back in time. Because remember, in Ragnarok, it got destroyed. And broke into pieces by Kate Blanchett. She broke it with her hand. They went back in time in Endgame, and he got it from back in time. And that's the one Steve has, or had. The one that got broken, stayed broken, and was on a weird museum display in New Asgard. And that's the one that shows up in this movie. But they do not explain that at all in this movie. And it was really freaking us out. So, I'm going to tell y'all up front. Also, the best thing I can say about this movie is just barely over 2 hours. That's pretty short for these things. There is one part I really enjoyed enough that I was like, this almost makes it worth it. But it lasts about 3 minutes. And while being incredibly awesome to watch, is incredibly fucked up. But I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But if you watch it, let me know. And then we'll talk about it. Anybody. Because I love talking about this part. But yeah, it's terrible. It's really bad. It's not unwatchable. It's just like, no, it's bad. So yeah, that's no good. I'm back at the gym. I've been fucking around and not going for like over a week for various reasons, none of them particularly good. But the last 2 days I have been going. Glad of that. I'm better when I exercise. We're watching season 2 of Hacks. It's still very good. It still occasionally stresses me out, but it's a very good show.
Won some awards, didn't it? Didn't it win some?
I think Jean Smart won the award for Best Actress 2 years in a row now for that show. I think she won it last year for season 1 and this year for season 2, which I don't begrudge her. She's fucking amazing, but that seems funny to me. Also,
Severance,
there is a really cool... Remember how Eternals ended and they had a post-credits thing where Harry Styles showed up?
Yeah.
There's a post-credits thing where somebody surprising shows up. and I would watch the shit out of the movie it promised if they did it, but I'm guessing it wouldn't actually happen. But there are a few very interesting casting choices in this film. All right. Enough of our crap. Let's read a thing.
All right. Episode 600 is going to have a thing.
Currently, the podcast is being kept alive by Jazz. Thank you, Jazz. All right. The subject on this one says politics and ethics in parentheses. Yes, a jazzy question.
Jazz.
I really hope you're using that in your classes. Like, time for a jazzy pop quiz. Speaking of this, I was just talking with my sister about this. So, you are probably familiar with issues that have recently come up, I say recently, in the last decade or so, with describing certain demographics in Central and South America. In that, for a long time, we said Latino, but Latin America is a specific sort of part of that, and not all of it qualifies. And then there's also Hispanic, but there are definitely parts of that that don't speak Spanish, like all of Brazil and shit like that. And so it doesn't work. And so they've come up with what is spelled Latinx. You familiar with this?
Yeah.
How do you pronounce that?
I don't. I've heard it pronounced Latinx.
Yes, as have I. And that kind of makes sense.
It does sound
a little like a cut-rate superhero.
I do have an opportunity, like in my homework, we'll have multicultural, like they'll want you to address multicultural aspects of a particular hypothetical client. And I'll never use Latinx. If it's a male client, I'll say Latino. And if it's a female client, I'll say Latina.
But what if they're not from Latin America, but of other Hispanic descent?
The hypothetical is always specific to say that. So,
it says a Latinx, and I think that works fine. If you actually know they're from Latin America, I think that's
right.
Like
right.
It, Latinx does not make Latino, Latina, or Hispanic non-functional. It's just there's a lot of circumstances where you can't the generality is in those, but you don't necessarily know, and it's not great to mix them
up.
So Latinx is a nice in between, and I've always heard it pronounced Latinx until recently. I want to say it was on a podcast, I don't know, and I also want to say it was somebody British who said Latinx.
I've heard that too, yeah.
I find that hilarious. It absolutely sounds like a boutique bathroom product of some sort. Feel fresh and clean with Latinx. I found it ridiculous, and then as I was joking about it with my sister today, I'm like, no, but I'm going to use it all the time now. I'm just going to say Latinx all the time. Like the shittiest knockoff beauty college. Come get your associates in hair care at Latinx. I always loved it. For those of you who aren't from around here, in Iowa City, we have admittedly a pretty good college of esthetology and hairdressing and all of the spa disciplines in town called La James, and pronounced La James, which for those of you unaware is French for the James
with a feminine article. So
yes. The female James.
I guess. The Lady James. I don't know.
And I love it. And I would never change it. And I love to talk about it. And actually, it's an awesome place. I got my wife. You can, a lot of these places, you can get really good spa treatments for a lot less than you would otherwise. And spa treatments are a huge racket with huge markup. So I have gotten my wife things to there. And actually, I think she got a lot of her prep for the wedding done at La James.
Mm.
La James. All right. Now that I have lightened the mood, let's get into Jazz's presumably dark and difficult question. An absolute sense of right and wrong is often used to fuel political ideologies, parentheses, usually with oppressive results. Hmm. How can politics achieve ethical purposes in a society without oppression / tyranny? Or is that impossible? I mean, did you send this to the right people? I mean, this seems like something you've stayed awake at night thinking about. So what do you have to say?
That I've stayed awake?
No. Yes.
It is impossible. but you know, status try anyway, and the way that the United States is supposed to do it is to, I mean, if you like read the Federalist Papers and stuff, and they knew that this probably wouldn't work. I mean, they had a goal here, but they knew that some people weren't going to want to do it this way. They knew that there were going to be people out there who wanted to impose their moral standards on everybody else. But the idea was that if you set up the Constitution and checks and balances and federalism and state sovereignty and all that stuff the right way, that you'd probably still get the kind of issues that Jazz is talking about on the state level or lower, but you would at least avoid it on the federal level. Well, and again, they suspected that there would be a lot of forces that would resist that. And of course, the fact that they, one of the things that they decided to not specifically deal with was slavery. And that was part of the bargain, right? It's like, well, federal level, we're just not going to deal with that stuff. And so if the states have to deal with it, then, that'll make things a little less tyrannical than if the federal government was allowed to do these things. Well, I mean, the slavery thing didn't get resolved without a civil war. So obviously that didn't work. So, I think even the the people who started all this in the United States knew that this was a long shot, that this would work. It didn't. And I think it continues not to. I think that it's about the best approach you could take, but I think the very fact that before they even did it, they could think of about 1,000 ways for it to fail shows that the very best thing you can come up with will still fail. Ergo, this is a futile, which that's part of the reason I'm an anarchist. But, again, some people believe that, well, no, we can still do it if we do this, if we do that. A lot of libertarians still believe if we stuck to that original goal of somehow keeping the federal government out of it, and then individual states, people, tried to apply that same principle to their states to say, look, you guys have, under the Constitution, you guys have the right to deal with these things, but you know what? We don't want you to. We want to handle it as a town, or we want to handle it as a township or a county, and sort of took, used the constitutional principles to take those rights even from the states and keep them local. Again, you'd still have local issues like what Jazz is talking about, but the idea is that if they're local, they're less horrific, I guess. I don't know.
Pervasive. Or maybe,
well, yeah, but also there's less of a chance that it's coercive. Like it's so local, actually 80% of the people buy into it. Now, there's the 20% that are still have oppressed by the majority, really, but 80% is pretty good. You're not going to get 80% of the people agreeing on a national or state level on anything. So, you know, if you push it all down to the local level far enough, there'll still be problems, but they won't be as tyrannical or oppressive, or, you know, you won't have so many disagreements and so much polarization.
They won't affect as many people. I don't want to say they won't be as tyrannical or oppressive.
Well, that's what
you could have a small scale that's very tyrannical.
Sure. I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Is it the number of people impacted is going to be different or whatever? Just the fact that I'm having difficulties stating it properly and correctly, I think is evidence that this is still not a good solution. And I think, yes, it's impossible. But I agree. I tend to agree with that idea of, you know, bigger is not better, and you know, keeping things local doesn't make problems go away, but it might make bad problems kind of stay in a little bit isolated geographically, and maybe more likely to get, you know, pushed out by competing things on either side. Because, you know, we tend to think that, well, if the federal government says it for everybody, then it fixes it. Well, it doesn't often do that at all. It often creates a thing that doesn't really work applied to everybody all at once. And then because it's federal, it's harder to change. You don't have states experimenting with different ways to do it so that better ways are figured out or found. So, you know, my opinion,
I appreciate the hypothesis. It feels a little bit like an argument from common sense, because I'm like, I don't think we've got any data to really, like, well, I follow your chain of reasoning, but I think there's a lot of assumptions being made there.
No, not just
to be fair, I don't think there couldn't be. I don't think there's a way to do it without that.
I think there's historical observations, although I will admit those historical observations are being interpreted through certain opinions.
And came at a time where technology in both communication and transportation were infinitesimal.
Yeah. So,
because how do you maintain it all at the local place when anybody, whether they live there or not, can just show up and do whatever the hell they want? I mean,
right,
if
anywhere.
I knew there was a town that was self-governing and they decided to keep slavery, I might want to do something about that.
Yeah. Well,
and I think that's part of the thing, is this idea, in the same way that people put up good and evil as, you know, absolutes, and I don't believe they are, in the same way, tyrannical and oppressive are also subjective terms.
I mean, in some contexts, yeah. I mean, it's certainly tyrannical if someone kills someone or rapes someone. I mean, that's clearly true. You can say it's justified.
I mean, in that case, I would say it very much not, because I don't think you can say one act against one from one person to another person is tyrannical. Really? I don't think that's the definition of to be a tyrant. I think that's
from a sociological standpoint, Carl Couch talked about the tyrannical relationship, and it definitely can be between two people. Absolutely.
Okay. I definitely wasn't talking about Carl Couch's definitions of sociological relationship.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Because like almost everyone in the world, I've never heard of them. I am talking about common, maybe pejorative, definitions of tyranny, which tend to be government and state based concepts.
So you think that term is applied only to states?
I mean, that, or polities at least. That is, I'm not saying that you did. I'm saying before Carl Couch came along, that had a definition, and he thought it was good for illustrating apparently a particular type of one-on-one relationship. I would argue that that is a slightly distinct definition and not the one I was talking about.
Fair enough.
Um, And I mean, I'll be serious about it. I don't think one person murdering another person can be considered universally like terrible or whatever else, regardless of the people involved. There are too many outlying factors. I personally don't like it and think it's awful, but I can't say it objectively. And I can't say there are too many things that it's all context specific.
But you could, but you can say it's coercive. I mean, you could say it's one person.
I can say that
asserting their will against someone else.
I can. Eliminating coercion, I think, is legitimately impossible in groups of any size, just by its very nature. Now, you can eliminate specific types of coercion. You're going to decide what those are.
You think there's coercion in our relationship?
Sometimes.
Well, it's news to me.
I think there's coercion in any situation where people are essentially trying to persuade or convince people to do things that they want that the other person doesn't necessarily.
Well, persuasion and coercion are different things.
All right. We're going to have to go to a new topic because you have, and don't get me wrong. No, I'm dead serious here, because you have very possibly incredibly accurate, but very specific definitions of my word choice. And it's clear that I don't have the same definitions.
I apologize.
And I'm no longer convinced that I might be using them wrong. And I'm not going to take the time right now to go look them up.
Well, I'm not sure.
I don't think this discussion can continue.
I don't think it's a right or wrong thing. I mean, I know what perspective I'm coming from, and I acknowledge that it's a pretty unique and very, you know, it's not a perspective that most other people are familiar with.
But it's also very, very semantic, because I'm trying to make points and you're not arguing my points. You're arguing the specific word choice I had. And that's maybe I should rephrase it this way. It's not a discussion I want to have.
No, I am. I think I am arguing your points. But if you are only hearing me arguing semantics, then I'm not making my point. So
yeah,
that's a problem.
But I think the terms in the question are as subjective as the concept of good and evil. And so, yes, I think it's impossible. And honestly, I think it's impossible on any scale. You're never going to do it, because the real answer is every circumstance, ideally, every interaction with every person and every disagreement and every decision made in a polity would be done on a case-by-case basis. And the problem with that is human fallibility.
Well, and see, the difference is I don't think it's impossible on every scale. And part of my point in saying that is, you know, some of the words that you're using matter to making that argument. Like, for me to argue why I think that's true, I would have to use some of the same words you're using, but I would have to use them very differently than you're using them, or come up with completely different words. That's, I wasn't trying just to be semantic. I was trying to make a point. And my point is, I think it is possible at certain scales.
I didn't get that from what you said up front. You're like, if it's just like, if it's a small number, then like 80% go along with it. To me, I'm like, well, 20% are still fucked.
No. But I'm talking about the size of a town or the size of a, that's still too big, is what I'm saying.
What scale are you down with?
Well, this has often been asked to me, because I'll say past a certain number, whatever. It's like, well, what number is it? Well, there isn't an absolute number, but probably, less than 100.
Okay.
Certainly less than
100. I will give you
probably less than 50.
A lot of luck and a very specific group of like-minded individuals, it is statistically possible. But in no way am I going to say that there's a number at which you'll be able to definitely do it if it's only that number of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the difference between deciding things by consensus versus saying, well, let's put it to a vote, you know, because it's consensus is going to take too long. And then that means that the percentage, and sometimes it's not even the majority, sometimes it's just a plurality that decides, well, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, you know, a group of five people can decide lots of everything, even by consensus. I mean, that's
not... Or a group of five people could not be able to achieve consensus. That's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah.
Is sure. It statistically possible sometimes, but it's not something I think you can design.
No, I mean,
I think so. Okay. I will admit it. With luck and a bit of random chance, I think it is possible in small enough scales in specific situations. But yeah, to me, that's a whole lot of random chance.
I mean, I guess I don't feel that pessimistic about it, but right. I mean, I also think that, you know, pretty much everything runs based on small groups anyway, even if everyone wants to think they don't, you know, they want to give credit to this corporation or this politician or this, that, or the other big thing. Ultimately, things get done by small groups of people and not usually by consensus. I'll grant you, usually there's someone who is the leader of that group or whatever. But of course, even in those situations, those groups function best when the leader is not just being dictatorial. It's not a democracy, certainly, but they're not just telling everybody what to do and they just do it like automatons or something. And this is how things actually get done. And the more things are like that, the better they'll get done, which again, won't eliminate problems from the world. You're still going to have
including people. Oppression and tyranny.
That's right. Those things will still happen.
And this is the thing. I 100% agree with pretty much everything you're saying in terms of this is the way to minimize it. To minimize what she's talking about. I just don't think you can eliminate
it. Oh, yeah. No, you can't eliminate
it. Impossible.
That's
didn't
utopianism.
You just make a really long argument about with a small enough scale, you can eliminate it?
No, I said the point I was trying to make was that at a small enough scale, you're still going to have all of these problems, but you won't have the large scale structures causing their problems on top of the problems that you're just going to have on the bottom.
That was what you argued 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, that was.
We were just talking where I was like, it's impossible to get rid of it. And you're like, I don't think so. On a small scale, I think it is.
Oh, I didn't understand what you're talking about. I thought you were making a statement about the probability of reaching consensus. I don't think reaching consensus is that hard. But I if you're saying that you don't think that kind of organization at the bottom is going to get rid of all of these problems. Well, no, of course it won't. That's not really the point.
But to me, the answer to Jazz's question then is yes, it's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's lots of things you can do to make it hopefully lessened. And there are circumstances that can work in your favor to make it better. But I think it's impossible to eliminate.
I mean, I should say that, you know, most of this relates to my general approach to anarchy. And I'm not, I think sometimes I run into issues with people, not you in particular, but other people when I'm talking about these things. It's like, I think there's a presumption that someone who is an anarchist is also, has a utopian view that if things were organized this way, there wouldn't be any problems.
Yeah.
No, there will be problems. The issue for anarchists like me is, yes, there are problems, and there are always going to be problems. Is when someone comes along and suggests a state to mitigate that, does that make sense? And to me, it doesn't. To me, the state will not mitigate that.
Yes.
I'm not saying it'll make it worse. But it can make it worse. I don't think it'll make it better. So that's kind of where I'm coming
from, which is a very clear and understandable statement that I think I agree with. And I think you got very caught up in expressing that view rather than specifically answering the question. And that may have been where we got into some miscommunication. There's sometimes, especially when you talk about anarchy, you describe it in a way like you're presuming presumptions on the other side of the conversation.
Maybe I am. I don't know.
Because the thing is, I mean, we had a very serious disagreement here. And even at its height, I agreed with almost everything you were saying. And yet also then it turned out, I guess I was agreeing with everything you were saying. But well, except the part that you were saying, because you weren't understanding what I was saying.
Yeah, I misunderstood you is what happened. And then I started off on a tangent that didn't make any sense because it was a complete misunderstanding of what you were talking about.
I think your perspective is very interesting and in fact has taught me a lot. I still consider myself largely a socialist rather than an anarchist, but that is largely socialism is potentially the best answer for the situation we are in. And I maintain that huge international revolution / global cataclysmic event would have to occur to create the model you have. And I agree that I like your model better if we could do that. But I'm like, assuming we're not doing that, stuck with what we have, I think I'm more in favor of socialism.
Yeah,
but we've also had this discussion and how that type of small group think and anarchic perspective works in modern politics. And I understand and appreciate your perspective. And I don't know that. I have a different view, but I'm honestly like, I'm not sure if I'm right or you're right. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I tend to think of our difference as it goes along those. I've talked about this before where when I was growing up, the progression of political views was you had anarchists and then you had libertarians would come along and say, we agree with you anarchists, but in the real world, this is how it's going to have to work.
Then
the Republicans would come along and say to the libertarians, we agree with you libertarians, but in the real world, this is how it has to work. And the Democrats would do the same. And then, you know, like the socialist progressives would do the same. Each one feels like, yeah, I see where you're coming from, but that's not the world we live in. So this, and I respect that 100%. I do.
But that's the thing. So based on that model, you and I are on opposite ends. But in reality, there's a weird sort of looping around. So we're kind of, I think we've discovered over the years, we're actually very close politically, though in the modern illustration of it, we sort of couldn't be further apart.
Well,
it's more like we agree about the picture. We agree about the picture and we agree about all the pieces and what they do. My definition of the best we can do with what we've got and your definition of the best we can do with what we've got are different, but we both are in agreement at what we got
pretty much
and what we want even, but our definition of what's gonna, you know, make the most good for the most people is different.
Well, and that's the whole point. I mean, the reason I use that illustration of each person saying, well, I understand what you're saying, but this is the real world. It's because most of those people agree on what we've got. What they differ is their opinion about, like you just said, well, what are we going to do with it? You know, and each successive level is really about a disagreement about on what's practical. Right. What can really be achieved? What's going to achieve justice, for example? Yeah. And since I can definitely admit that my vision would, without causing a cataclysm, which I don't want, would take a long time might involve policies that actually make government get bigger for a little while. You know, it's not this linear thing that's going to get to what I want to see. I understand someone looking at it and saying, well, William, that's really impractical. And I was like, yeah, I know what, I mean, I still have my opinions and my principles that I'm going to stick to, but I understand your perspective perfectly well.
Well, and I also have a problem with that. Consider my perspective to be fairly impractical as well. But no, I would disagree. I mean, there is a lot of everybody sees the same thing and we disagree on how to fix it. I think there's also a lot of everybody not seeing the same thing.
I think it's kind of true these days. Sure.
Yeah. Like, what are the problems in our country? Oh, drugs are rampant. Oh, the border is too flexible. I don't think any of that is a problem.
Yeah, you're right about
that. Oh, people are mean to the police. Yeah, I don't find that a thing. Like, yeah. And you and I, and I think you and I are in agreement as largely as to what even happens. I think if you had a socialist agenda and did this, this would happen. I think you'd probably say, yeah. And if you had an anarchist agenda and did this, this would happen. And I'd say, yeah. And we'd both be like, I just think I'd rather have mine.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. I think you and I, the pieces of the puzzle are the same. How we disagree on how we personally would like to orient it.
Well, and I'm used to people, you know, thinking I'm just not practically minded about it. I get that.
No, and that's I mean, there was a time I think when I thought that, but that was years ago. No, I understand your perspective. I do think you are dangerous when discussing with other people, getting a little bit into the weeds of your education, as demonstrated. I believe Carl Couch was the one who said, a lot of people don't know shit about what I've said. I believe that's a famous quote from him. But you know, I'm also not innocent of that particular thing as well. Let me talk to you about what I've learned from experiencing Yanni's music.
Experiencing what?
Yanni's music.
Yanni's music?
Yeah. I was a huge Yanni fan when I was younger. I went to see him in concert.
You did?
I spent my own money to see Yanni in concert. Oh,
wow. When was that?
Okay, so here's what happened. So I'm going along living my life as a teenager.
How old were you exactly? Tell me. I need to know.
I don't know.
Well, somebody I didn't know who Yanni was until 1987.
Well, that's the thing. Somebody can figure it out based on my story here.
Oh, okay.
There are events, public events, but I don't remember. Sometime I'm a teenager.
Okay.
And we don't have cable. So we only
that
have
has to be channels. After 87.
And we watch PBS. And I turn to PBS. And they have Yanni live at the Acropolis, which was his big sort of concert film or whatever.
He's Greek, right?
Yes.
So that was a thing.
And so it was a big deal. And yeah. I think it's what put him into a broader
aware. Okay.
It made him famous sort of at the time. Before then, he was a new age musician. And people who were into that, because I've since found out he had earlier albums. And he's got really funny looking hair, and there's a lot.
Well, that's
of
all I knew like was that. New age stuff. He
Live at the Acropolis, and he's got a whole orchestra and a whole jazz band and all this stuff. And he does this huge stuff, and I am in rapture. Okay. And I buy the CD, and I listen to it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It's one of those CDs that's in my brain. I can go through every note of the long violin solos that take place in some of these things still to this day. And I pick up some other sort of collections of things that he did that weren't live produced in the same way. And I got really into it, and I went and I saw him live, and it's just really big, bombastic orchestral music with some really cool electronic stuff thrown in. And I really loved it. And also he was a pretty man with long hair, and I was the right age for that. Not really putting together what that meant to me yet, but, and yeah, I fell in love. I also rediscovered Sade because they did a concert on PBS of her Love Deluxe album, and I went out and bought it. And I knew Sade, but great. I basically knew Sade for Smooth Operator.
Yeah, she's great.
And then Love Deluxe came out, and I listened to Love Deluxe till my brain melted. Yeah, I was really big into Yanni. And, I went to college, and a lot of people shamed me for that.
Shamed you? Why?
Yeah, because it's, I mean, to use it in its more technical term, it's pop music. It's not, the people who shamed me were by and large music students. And they're like, it's not, it's 16 bars over and over again, the same shit. Well, and I was like, okay. That's true. And then I went to the jazz festival one year and the headliner was John Tesh at a jazz festival. And I was like, it could be worse. John Tesh is a similar style of music, but it's just four bars over and over and over again.
I hadn't heard of Yanni until 1987 when my roommate had his albums. Now, my roommate was a musician and he liked jazz. He liked all kinds of music. So, and he thought Yanni was great. Now, this must have been the Yanni you weren't familiar with because you wouldn't have been a teenager in 87.
No, 10. No. This would have been where he had his albums had titles like Chameleon or Sky something. I don't know.
When I was introduced to
him, it was just shot to him with like a sort of fake afro standing in front of electronic keyboards and there were like clouds in the background. And yeah.
But you got to know some of his older stuff though.
Some. I was more into the Acropolis album and then a couple of them. I bought a couple of other CDs and I would listen to them a lot. And in fact, one of them to this day makes me think of a particular fantasy book series because I listened to it the whole time I was reading those books. And so now I associate those songs with it. But yeah, I was a big guy. The first concert tickets I ever purchased were for Yanni concert.
Really?
Technically, I think it's the second concert I ever went to, but it's the first one I ever bought tickets for.
What was the first concert?
A lesser known a cappella group that my family were big fans of called the Nylons. It was four flamingly gay men who did some really cool a cappella songs. And they were playing at the Clark County Fair. And I think that's the first real concert I ever went to. I should see if they're on to Apple Nudes. Because I got all this stuff. Like, I got my Yanni albums back on there. And sometimes I listen to them. And it's handy because it's instrumental stuff. And so it's good if I'm, like, writing. I can have that in the background. If there's lyrics, I get too distracted. But
I don't listen to anything when I'm writing. I don't know if that would help me or not.
I think it's a little bit of a focus thing. I think there's some part of my brain that would likely get distracted if I didn't. And it keeps that part busy. But if there's too much for other parts of my brain to hook on, it doesn't work. It has to be instrumental music that I am very familiar with.
Oh, okay. So it,
Or other things. I've also had ones where I will put just incredibly generic because there's like background music YouTube channels. So I'll put on like smooth jazz. It's like an 8-hour thing.
Yeah.
And it's just nothing music. And so my brain doesn't have to pay attention. And that works too. There's also a guy, EDM guy called Blackmill. And he does a lot of stuff that, is just the equivalent of, you know, a thin gruel running through my brain musically. And that keeps me nourished while I can focus on other things. I mean, that's not the right metaphor, but it's close. Getting to something. All right, we're over time. So we'll probably be back next week. I mean, why not? Sure. We've already done 600. Why would we stop now? If you'd like to talk about the stuff that we talk about, jazz, I assume. Maggie, maybe. She's bouncing around. You don't know because you don't get notifications. You should set it up. You should subscribe to the blog, and it should tell you anytime anybody makes a comment on any episode. because she's hopping around to hundreds of episodes back and making comments.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to respond to things, but I'm all on my own there because, well, for technical reasons that I wouldn't say, for fear it would bog people down with details and also destroy our paper thin premise. magically. But yeah, go to the blog, magicflyinghat.com, and tell us what you thought about this. Tell us your feelings about Yanni or Laurel. I don't care, whichever one. And also go to YouTube, smash that like button and subscribe and hit the bell to get notifications.
Smash.
I love the idea of somebody hitting the bell to get notifications. Oh my God, it's Thursday. Look, there's another one. You know, sometimes Facebook tells me somebody's birthday was yesterday.
But not the day is their birthday? Huh. That's not helpful at all.
No. Also go to aethertheater.com and look at all of William's shit. William has a lot of shit over there. Some of which I am somewhat involved with, but mostly not. Also go to smashwords.com and pick up my novel, Odd Wings. I glued it to my neighbor's hand and he said he couldn't put it down. I'm going to tell you a therapy joke. And I'll tell you why I'm going to tell you. Because I heard it and it made me laugh. And ever since then, I'm like, I'm going to tell my therapist. And then more and more, I'm like, I'm not actually sure it's that funny. So maybe I'm not. So then I'll tell you instead.
Okay.
It was actually a stand-up who's talking about that therapist. But I'm going to translate it into a generic joke because it works fine this way.
Okay.
So patient is going in for their first therapy appointment. And they're very nervous. And they're like, so should I call you doctor? And the therapist says, actually, I don't have a doctorate. I just have a master's degree. And the patient says, okay, should I call you master? That's it. That's the joke.
That's it?
That's it.
Yeah, it's no, it's not very funny.
If you thought it was funny, go to the blog. MagicTalkingHead.com. Tell William.
What was funny about it exactly? Maybe I am dead inside.
That people who have a doctorate, we call them doctor. But if you have a master's degree, you don't call them master. That would be hugely inappropriate and socially unacceptable in the world in which we live. And yet, it is a very clear analogy because people who have a doctorate, we call them a doctor. See? So it's just a weird little slice of life. How it's Gallagher standing up there and being like, how come we call people with doctorates doctor, but people with master's degrees, we don't call them master? Huh? Isn't that weird? How come we park on a driveway and drive on a parkway? What's the deal with airline food? It's that kind of thing. It's observational humor.
Okay. Did I say I have a cold? I have a cold.
I hope this therapy gig works out because you have no future as a comedian.
It's this cold I've got. I shouldn't. I ate a whole bar of chocolate hoping it would give me a little boost. I don't think it did.
This just in, folks. Dark chocolate will not cure a cold. Despite the controversy out there.
Huge internet. Seriously. Twitterverse controversy.
I would not tell a patient at my job unprompted my climate change views. And my climate change views are incredibly widespread. I would say they are the most common views by a very large margin. They are arguably the near consensus views of society.
Mm.
What the hell is going on in your head if you have views that aren't those views and you feel the need to tell your patient?
I don't know.
That's nuts. I mean, and I tell people a lot of things I shouldn't tell them. Like, I got a rash. You want to know where?
No.
But I might still tell you because I'm that messed up of a person. But I would not tell you my climate change views while I was working as your sleep tech.
Yeah, I get it.
I'll tell you another thing. I don't actually have a rationale right now, but it was a good example. I think. Oh, honestly. I'm lying. I absolutely have a ratch. It's really good. It's really, you want to see? It's right in.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.